Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. King County says more of its people go into detox for heroin use than they do for alcohol. Well, some elected leaders want to build supervised injection sites, places where drug users can shoot up under medical supervision, with the idea being to keep people from overdosing, to get those people help to stop using, fewer used needles lying around, fewer people using public bathrooms to shoot up. The county's decided to build one safe injection site in Seattle and another in a different part of King County. Tonight, the Bellevue City Council is expected to vote to ban supervised injection sites from its city. Bellevue Mayor John Stokes, welcome to KUOW.
Well, thank you, and glad to be here.
Why are you banning these supervised injection sites from Bellevue?
Well, when it was first brought to us, you know, we didn't know a whole lot about it. It was King County was talking about having the safe injection sites, the CHEL sites, one in Seattle and one somewhere in King County. I mean, realistically, if they're going to put another one somewhere, it's probably not going to be Bellevue. There's a lot greater need in other places, according to the data.
You've said that there's more of a need in South King County than in Bellevue, but why not leave that up to the county? Why come in and say no supervised injection sites in our city?
The potential of locating or even agreeing to locate a safe injection site would just cause a lot of, you know, concern about and raise the level of anxiety. We think, one, needlessly, and two, Bellevue just isn't ready to take on that, if it was going to happen, take on that whole responsibility, and not really sure that this is the best way to go on this.
What are those? You mentioned there's concern and anxiety. What are the concerns and anxieties about such an injection site in Bellevue?
What the opponents, what people look at, and which is some parts of a real concern, is having injection sites of having people openly using, you know, illegal drugs at a site, having attracting people who are drug addicts to the area. People have visions of seeing what they may have seen in other places, where, and you know, in alleys or in some building or outside a building, is a drug use and.
But isn't part of the idea
to, kind of thing.
Yes, isn't part of the idea to bring the use out of the alleys and into a supervised place with staff hooking users
right.
up with services.
Right. Well, what I understand that, and I think that we have not thoroughly, you know, looking at the whole piece, because we don't think it's ready for Bellevue at this time. But on your point, part of the thing that people have been concerned about, and what appears to also happen, is it's you can say that it's going to be inside and it's going to be safe, but you have to make sure it doesn't happen other places. And it appears that, looking at other data in other cities, and there are very, very few places that have done this. Vancouver is the example that people give, is that it can attract people and there can be usage outside. So that's been the fear that's come up. So that's why one of the reasons it's a concept that is still in progress in terms of working it out and how it would work, and you know, Seattle, if they want to do one in Seattle, we'll see how that works. That would be good. Now, we do have some council members who, you know, say no way, no time anywhere in Bellevue, and that's another conversation. I think.
Do you agree with that? Never.
No,
in Bellevue?
No, I think if it can be shown to be to save lives, it can be shown to be done in a way that's respectful to the community. If it can be done in a safe way and a clean way, in a sense of this not just turning into a shoot up alley or something like that, I think we have a responsibility to work with people who, a lot of addicts are simply neighbors, often, you know, family members, friends, or people just really down on their luck, and all these things. We have responsibility to do that, and we're doing that in a lot of ways in Bellevue, working with other organizations. But at this point, this concept is just not at that point where it's right for Bellevue now.
Are we in a situation of not in my backyard? So the city after city says, not here, not here. because you're not against the idea completely, you've said, but you know, but where to do it?
Well, I think we're saying that while some people may be entirely against it at any time and not in Bellevue, and that can be translated into, you know, not in my backyard, I think what most people are saying is that we don't think that this is something that we want to get into right now. We don't think it's proven. We think it has all these other pieces that go into it. It's not the right time.
Okay.
And I think that's a difference. And yes, I mean, that is always a problem, and that's that remains to be seen legally how all this gets worked out. I would think that maybe there are some cities in King County that have such a high level of a problem that they may be willing to or want to do this.
Bellevue Mayor John Stokes, thanks for the time.
All right, thank you.
The Bellevue City Council will be voting on this ordinance tonight, and the council is expected to ban supervised injection sites from that city. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to talk about who might be the next mayor of Seattle, also surveillance in the city of Seattle. How much say should the public have in how the city watches what we do? That's coming up on The Record. A former deputy director at Washington's Fish and Wildlife Department is awaiting trial on charges he raped a coworker. That case has revealed a sexually charged culture within the agency. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports in collaboration with the News Tribune of Tacoma.
It was the evening of December 17th, 2014. Senior managers from the Fish and Wildlife Department gathered for their annual holiday party at an Italian restaurant in Olympia.
You know, I had a nice dinner, and that broke up between 7:30 and 8.
This is the agency's deputy director, Joe Storr. He says after the dinner, he went home, but a small group headed for the bars.
The next day or the day after, heard that one of our senior managers was attacked.
The story was someone had broken into her home the night of the party and raped her while she slept. The police were investigating. Soon the name of a possible suspect surfaced, Greg Sherrato, the deputy assistant director of the wildlife program. The case hit the news in April 2015. This was the report on King 5.
Today, Deputy Assistant Director Greg Sherrato was charged with rape and burglary in Thurston County. The charges come after a four-month police investigation.
While police investigated the alleged crime, Fish and Wildlife hired an outside law firm to investigate dueling allegations of sexual harassment by Sherrato and his alleged rape victim. The findings of that report have not been made public until now. The report described Sherrato as an influential member of the executive management team who often talked about sexual topics at work and even tried to recruit coworkers to engage in sex. Sherrato described his life as unorthodox but told investigators he maintained a bright line and did not discuss sex or use sexualized language at work. Coworkers told a different story. One manager said Sherrato regularly talked about getting naked at parties. Another employee said Sherrato told her about meeting a couple and going up to their hotel room to watch them have sex. Even Deputy Director Joe Storr recalled Sherrato telling him at work about a birthday party in Las Vegas that involved women in a hot tub.
And it was just kind of a passing comment, and I thought, oh, that's kind of odd, and just kind of, you know, kept going.
In fact, the report shows a pattern of letting Sherrato's behavior slide. For instance, his workplace conversations had triggered two previous complaints, but in both instances, they were not reported to senior managers or to human resources, and no action was taken against him. Kristen Hauser is with the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. She says inappropriate behavior in the workplace needs to be addressed immediately.
When you have managers and supervisors who don't respond right away or at all, that inaction has the outcome of normalizing an environment that can become completely dysfunctional.
Fish and Wildlife is mostly run by men. Women in the agency found different ways to deal with the sexualized environment. One said she put up with it because she didn't want to make mountains out of molehills. Another said she focused on improving her relationship with Sherrato because he was part of her work family. A third described herself as a consensual and active participant in conversations about sex. Hauser says all of these are classic responses.
When supervisors aren't addressing these behaviors, that means your employees end up suffering in silence, or they can take another job, or they can join in. And when the people join in, it becomes toxic, and then you end up with a much greater cultural problem within the organization.
In the end, Sherrato was fired, although he's appealing to get his job back. Richard Woodrow is Sherrato's criminal defense attorney. He says the culture at Fish and Wildlife is a factor in the alleged rape case.
I think that set the background for the accusation to be made.
Woodrow says he's confident Sherrato will be found not guilty at trial, and he suggests Fish and Wildlife is culpable for not better policing the line between professional and personal lives.
Not only did people cross that line, but other people saw it, and nobody seemed to feel that that was an issue.
The report concludes there's no evidence upper-level managers at Fish and Wildlife condoned inappropriate workplace conduct. To this day, Deputy Director Joe Storr insists this was a small group of people and not reflective of the agency at large.
I can understand how people would think that if that's the way they behave, that's a widespread problem. That's not my sense.
Storr says no one besides Sherrato was fired or disciplined as a result of the report's findings, nor has the agency undertaken a broader effort to assess or change the workplace culture. However, employees have been encouraged to come forward if they witness or experience harassment or inappropriate behavior in the workplace. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter now at KUOW. We still don't know who's going to be on the November ballot for Seattle mayor. It'll be former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin versus either Carrie Moon or Nikita Oliver. Durkin won last week's primary, but she didn't get a majority of the votes. She got about 30%. So who gets those votes in the general election? Durkin has the support of big labor unions, environment, and business groups. She was appointed U.S. attorney by President Obama. But could she be denied by a bloc of Seattle liberals who voted for the five other candidates who ran to her left? My guest, John Weibel, thinks that could happen. He's a political consultant in Seattle with Wind Power Strategies. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Also with us, Christian Sinderman with NWP Consulting. Christian, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay, so Jenny Durkin, there's about 20,000 votes between her and her nearest opponent. I mentioned endorsements for Durkin, but John, you say Durkin is not actually the front runner now. How does that work?
Well, I think that the other five candidates were to the left of Jenny Durkin, and when you add that total up, the math would suggest that a lot of those votes would go to either Carrie Moon or Nikita Oliver, and put them at a little bit of an advantage going into the general.
Okay, it's math. John arguing that the anti-Durkin vote ran to her left, Seattle's electorate's moving left. Christian, what about that idea that Durkin, who's the country's first openly gay U.S. attorney, appointed by Barack Obama, not liberal enough for Seattle? Can you just add up the other 70% and swear in Mayor Moon? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a simplistic way of looking at it, and I think the one thing we do know for sure is that mayoral elections in Seattle over the last two or three cycles have all been very close. It was close 4 years ago. It was close 4 years before that. And there is a real shift in the electorate, and it's a very progressive city, obviously. But, you know, if you look at the other five candidates, there were candidates, you know, like Justin Farrell and Bob Hasegawa, who may have had, you know, mildly more progressive platforms, but we're also candidates with deeper resumes, something that either Carrie Moon or Nikita Oliver doesn't bring to the table. They're candidates that had stronger platforms or other platforms on LGBTQ issues, which is an area of strength for Jenny Durkin as well. So I don't think it's quite as easy as just adding up the rest of the votes. It's a bigger electorate. It's an electorate that's going to be looking more in depth at these two candidates, something that in primaries don't happen, and it's going to be a close race no matter what.
John, in what way is Jenny Durkan the establishment candidate? We seem to be fighting over that label, and we're going to be hearing that a lot. Progressive, establishment, what's this mean to you?
I think usually the way that voters look at these candidates is where their money is coming from. And I think in the case of Jenny Durkan, you can see a lot of business and downtown support. And, you know, similar to Joe Malahan in 2009, where he received a lot of business support and fairly or not fairly got tagged as kind of a business establishment candidate, the same thing could happen to Jenny Durkan.
Agreed, Christian?
I think there's, well, to compare Jenny Durkan and Joe Malahan is actually deeply insulting to Jenny Durkan, who does have a significant and lengthy civic resume, obviously served in the Obama administration, and really does have her own strong profile as a community leader. So I don't think that's a totally fair comparison. But yeah, if we're using the word establishment either through gritted teeth or as a badge of honor, it is true that you know, that because of the strong institutional endorsements that you mentioned, you know, she will wear that badge for better or for worse.
John, you worked on former Mayor Mike McGinn's campaign. Did McGinn supporters tell you who their number two choice was?
They didn't. I think, you know, he had some loyal supporters. I think, you know, he had a base before in the South End that went much more to Nikita Oliver and Bob Hasegawa in this election. So, you know, I think Nikita supporters and where they go is very interesting in this race. I think I question the resume part of what Christian is saying. We've had a number of new mayoral candidates that didn't have a lot of executive experience when they got elected, including Ed Murray, Mike McGinn, Greg Nichols, just to go back the last three mayors. I think people are more looking for someone that connects with their values.
What's your evidence for that?
My evidence would be the previous mayors that they've elected.
What do you think, Christian? How do you know whether people are voting for resumes or values or looking at endorsements or big funders? How do you know?
I think it's a combination. And this is one reason why Mayor Murray was successful in defeating Mike McGinn was because he not only shared the progressive values but had the resume and the credentials to back it up. And that likely would have carried him to re-election had not a lot of other situations evolved over the last several months. But you know, the race between Joe Malahan and Mike McGinn was a race between two people without deep civic ties and without resumes. So there was strictly about a values connection, and I think the positioning meant more than it did 4 years ago in the Murray McGinn race, or this year, where you know you have two progressive women who will be running. The composition of those two likely determined, but still some votes outstanding, obviously, and it really is going to be, I think, you know, more about what people bring to the table and the direction they provide for the future.
John, some of the issues that Jenny Durkan has talked about, she wants to add multifamily housing in single-family neighborhoods, and she supports Ed Murray, Mayor Murray's strategy on homelessness, she says, his Pathways Home strategy, and we have Durkan supporting the idea of supervised heroin injection sites. Is there an issue that think most is going to separate these two candidates, whoever they are, in November?
Well, I think on homelessness and housing affordability, I mean, these are huge issues for the city of Seattle. And I don't know how just saying we're going to keep doing what we're doing when we have 4,000 in the last count, I think, homeless, and we're, you know, definitely in the top five in least affordable cities. Just saying we're going to keep the path that we're on is a good strategy for her. I think that's a place where Kerry could get some traction with a real strong, bold plan on both how we solve our homelessness problem issues and how we deal with affordability.
Kristen, does a candidate endorsing a mayor's progressive direction, is that still essentially status quo versus a voting block of people saying this is not enough?
Yeah, I think on issues of affordability and homelessness, there's nothing is enough, and I think that's been the challenge confronting the city and confronting the you know hundreds of thousands of Seattle voters and residents who are yearning for long-term solutions. I think the process that we've seen to develop Pathways Home and develop the housing affordability and livability package are extremely well thought out. They're comprehensive. Will they solve the problem entirely? Of course not. Not any one thing can or will. So I think it's a both-and strategy. We should continue the good work that's been done by the mayor and council and community leaders and service providers to set this direction, to build affordability, build more affordable housing, and address the opioid crisis. And then we need more solutions. We need more innovations. And I think, you know, that hopefully the candidates will have things to share with us. And obviously the folks closest to the ground will offer their own solutions. But I think it's important to continue that good work.
I'm talking with political consultants John Weibel and Christian Sinderman. Finally, who do you predict it's going to come down to between Kerry Moon and Nikita Oliver? John?
I think Christian and I might agree on something here, which is I think Kerry Moon will be the second choice here through the primary.
Agreed, Christian?
Yeah, I do. I think there's not enough votes left to count, and Moon has too much of a lead going into these final votes.
Even though the Nikita Oliver campaign wants to really challenge the count?
Yeah, I think even though there's, having done, John and I have both worked on a lot of ballot chasing in our lives, especially around legislative campaigns and even in those smaller jurisdictions, you know, you need to, it takes a lot of work to rehabilitate ballots, and it's not easy to do. And when there's 21 candidates in the field, it's a small numbers game. And if it was a gap of 100, maybe it's possible. But if it's over 1,000, it'd be very, very difficult.
Okay, we'll watch how this small numbers game plays out. We've been talking with campaign consultants John Weibel with Wind Power Strategies and Christian Sinderman of NWP Consulting talking about our unfolding mayoral campaign. Thanks to you both.
No problem.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information coming up. Surveillance and who is art for? Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Now we're going to talk about how the city of Seattle surveils. The Seattle Police Department uses surveillance technology, cameras, software, and the city just passed a law giving the public more say about that technology. The law was supported by the ACLU of Washington, and in the studio is the group's technology director, Shankar Narayan. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What is your evidence that the public ought to sign off on police surveillance technology? Is there a problem already?
Well, we have certainly seen these kinds of powerful surveillance technologies misused elsewhere when they were implemented without community input. I'll give you just one example. So automated license plate readers, what are commonly known as ALPRs, This is a technology that's often used for parking enforcement. It's used, for example, for tolling purposes in Washington State. In New York City, they had these devices, and they used them for several years to surveil worshipers coming to and from mosques. Now, there was no public debate about this, but certainly when the Muslim community heard about it, they were unhappy about it. They weren't sure where the data was going, what it was going to be used for, whether it could be used to target individuals who were worshiping at that mosque. So that's just one example. You know, there are clear benefits to ALPR technology. It's not that we're saying it should be taken off the table entirely, but when it's implemented, it shouldn't just be law enforcement that makes those decisions. It should be the community and their representatives having a chance to weigh in and saying, here are uses that are good and beneficial, where we get some public safety benefit, and here perhaps are uses that we would like to take off the table because they're not in line with our values.
And this is not to this new law, this is not the people voting on surveillance technologies. This is just the city council taking a look at only new technologies or any kind of surveillance by Seattle Police?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what this does is it doesn't restrict particular surveillance technologies. It sets up a process by which the city council not only has the ability to approve new surveillance technologies but that are being implemented, but will also take a backward look and on a month-to-month basis approve technologies that the city already has that fall into this category of powerful surveillance technologies, but that were never daylighted when they were first acquired.
Also with us is an opponent of this law, former Assistant Director of the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division, Ron Hosko. Welcome, Ron.
Hey, good to be with you today.
Ron is president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund as well. And Ron, what would be wrong with giving the public a chance to approve surveillance methods that affect them or could affect them?
Well, I think from my experience, there would be many problems with it. First and foremost, we live in a society where many of the law enforcement techniques that are used by federal, state, local law enforcement are exposed to public view over time, typically in court filings or in court hearings. And the reality about crime fighting is simple. This is, you know, very often a cat and mouse game. And as new techniques are developed by law enforcement, they're exposed to the criminal element in our societies. And the criminal element adapts. They evolve. They learn what techniques caught them the last time or caught their friends in who may be part of a conspiracy, and they evolve, they change their tactics to try to inflict their harm on society in new and inventive ways. And I think exposing those techniques, particularly sophisticated surveillance techniques, to the public is tantamount to showing your cards about how law enforcement works and how they might keep a step ahead of the criminal element in our country and certainly in Seattle.
Shankar, does the city of Seattle have some way to keep the bad guys from learning about surveillance through the public process, or do you just think that's not a problem?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the Seattle Police Department supported this ordinance. We worked very closely with them to make sure that we were including language that really referred to the public's ability to talk about how the technology was used, but wasn't necessarily revealing the intimate details of the specs of that particular technology, for example. And so, you know, I think the approach that SPD has taken and many other police departments are swinging around to as well is an approach that centers community trust. We often have a debate where community trust is an afterthought, and these surveillance techniques are acquired sometimes, again, without even the higher-ups in a particular department knowing about it. There'll be aggressive marketing by vendors of the technology who might provide subsidies. The federal government might provide subsidies, and the agency might then say, well, hey, it's free to use. Let's go ahead and implement it and see what happens. Unfortunately, what that doesn't consider is the impact on public trust. Will people, you know, particularly crime victims, witnesses, immigrants and refugees, other vulnerable communities be reluctant to interact with police departments if they believe they're being surveilled and if they don't know how that information is being used. So I think the approach that this bill puts out is a very rational one, where we're not revealing particular secrets of the technology to the bad guys, but we certainly are talking about how this technology might be implemented in a way that also preserves public trust and civil liberties.
Ron, isn't that an upside of such a law like this in Seattle, public trust of their police department?
Well, public trust is really a critical aspect of any law enforcement agency's engagement with the public. And I would, you know, cautiously agree with, you know, reasonable, responsible steps to build that public trust. That's often done with police leadership. And to me, one of the more important facets of a law like this, or a consideration like this, would be, what are the policy discussions behind it, and how are they communicated to the citizens? Rather than showing off a piece of innovative technology and sharing how it might be utilized in a anti-crime environment, talk to me about build trust with the police chief and with police commanders that are developing policies that are properly informed. They're informed not just by the law of land, according to the Supreme Court, but by people within the city solicitor's office or the district attorney's office, prosecutors who have a clear understanding of what the law expects, what it requires, and building appropriate policies and policy judgments and sharing that with the public rather than showing off your shiny new tools so that dedicated criminals can evade them.
Shankar, you used the example early on of automated license plate readers and how in New York those were used to track people coming from mosques. In Seattle, how would a situation like that play out under this law? I mean, there's approving a technology, but then there's looking over the police department's shoulder at how it's specifically being used day in and day out. How does that work?
Well, I think ALPRs is actually a great example because when the council talked about ALPRs as
these are the license plate readers.
Yes, these are the license plate readers. One council member, Mike O'Brien, said, well, when we had this debate, all we really talked about was parking enforcement. And so what we know is that SPD has a database of ALPR location data, which amounts to a massive trove of location data on everyone who drives in the city, because these devices are quite ubiquitous. And this database is piling up with no restriction on who can use it and how. And, you know, in addition to, for example, a smart criminal who might get these records through a public records request and, say, determine when you're home or not, it also is potentially abusable by the federal government. Now, Seattle has declared itself a welcoming city and has said that they don't want to participate in federal immigration enforcement. And yet, here's a trove of location data which could be used for that purpose. So what I would say is that, you know, when ALPRs come up for city council approval, as they now must, we should put those things on the table. We should talk about what are they currently being used for? Are there useful applications, for example, for finding stolen vehicles? How long do you really need the data? All right, a stolen vehicle match on a hot list, for example, really only takes an immediate match when that license plate is recorded, but 2 or 3 days later, it's not really as important, and certainly 30 days later, the value of that data has gone down a lot. So why are we keeping it?
And beyond license plate readers, Ron Hosko, technology changes, software changes, drone technology, GPS trackers. What is your answer to the question of the use of surveillance beyond trust the police? How do we keep surveillers in check?
Well, you can, as my organization, my former organization worked hard to do, it's trust but verify. And so within the FBI, we used the full range of surveillance and other techniques, some of which were debated in Congress, not the, you know, the details of a particular surveillance platform, but tools and techniques that the FBI uses. We had internal compliance measures. I was an inspector at one point in my career. We had internal audit units. We had an inspector general, all of which, you know, had among their requirements, their expectations, that they were looking at the organization, its efficiency, its effectiveness, ways to improve both of those, and compliance against existing policy and law. And those reviews, in my estimation, were robust. People were from time to time sanctioned with suspension or termination for violating the expectations of the organization. Divisions of the FBI and leadership might be criticized for, you know, lack of clarity in the execution of a policy or the execution of a policy. So there were robust internal and external mechanisms to do to look over the shoulder of the police department and make sure that they are working as they had agreed to.
Okay, well, we'll pause it there and keep watching the watchers as this brand new law plays out. Ron Hosko, former assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division, president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Ron, thank you.
Great to be with you.
And from the ACLU of Washington, the Technology and Liberty Project Director, Shankar Narayan, as I say, we'll watch how this law actually gets implemented. I imagine the ACLU is going to do the same.
We will be watching as well. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in and telling us about it. KUOW's The Record, back in a moment. We're going to be talking about the King County Arts and Culture sales tax that went down to defeat. One of the criticisms was elitism in some of the arts organizations that would have benefited. So we're going to talk about who art is for in Seattle and King County. So stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Access for All. That was the name of the proposition that would have raised retail sales tax in King County to fund arts and culture programs for diverse and underserved populations. Voters in King County rejected the new tax. As of today, the proposition was failing by 3%. Critics of Access for All, like King County Councilmember Larry Gossett, said too much of the money from the tax would go to big arts organizations with big budgets, places like the Symphony and the Ballet that already get big sums of money. They also, he said, serve mainly people of a white middle-class background.
It's not people's art. It's not progressive art. It's not revolutionary art that these 32 entities provide for the public. So why we get buses and go out to inner city schools to take them to see that.
How do we fund art that is for everyone, that serves everyone? Philip Shavita is executive director of Intamon Theater in Seattle. Shantina Vernon is a Seattle playwright and singer-songwriter. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Shantina, you just heard Councilmember Gossett talking about a kind of art that gets considered, I think he used the phrase, high-level culture, Shakespeare, Swan Lake, Mozart. What do you think about that charge?
I think it's accurate in terms of just what my experience is of the institutions that he speaks of. And most of them are coming from the sort of white dominant cultural lens. And I think that if we're really going to have access for all, then you have to find those organizations that are already doing work in communities that are diverse and marginalized communities and figure out ways to be more direct in the support and getting the resources and access to them.
So we all know what we're talking about. Is there an example of a moment in a Shakespeare play or a Swan Lake pas de deux or a Mozart concerto? When does that art feel exclusive to you?
I think when the narrative that's presented through the art is sort of singular and repeated over and over throughout a season, and it's not really told with any kind of nuanced cultural overlay that makes it relevant to different groups of people, right? To some, you know, I'm a trained writer and performer. I went to graduate school, and that those works are heralded as the canon, and you know, the sort of the example of what is good art, right? Mm-hmm. But so much of the time, in terms of like my studies, I had questions about like, how is this narrative relevant to me and to where I come from? You know, I grew up in the South. I come from, you know, a Black working class family. And so those were not necessarily the stories that we heralded as our canons. And nobody was really asking me any questions about, well, like, who are your playwrights and who are your makers? And it was always as if here is an example of what is proper form and what is proper technique. But there are many approaches to art. And so much of the time, those approaches and different angles and different narratives are not included.
Philip Chervita, as I said, Intiman Theater in Seattle. What's your take on all this?
Well, I'm happy to be in Seattle. I've been here for about 5 months.
Uh-huh.
But I do have a lot
Welcome.
Of years of, thank you very much. I'm loving this weather.
It's always like this.
Heard. Uh-huh. But I have worked in the art for some time, most recently working on Broadway. And when we talk about revolutionary art, I'm interested what people think.
That was a phrase, by the way, that Councilmember Gossett used, revolutionary.
Yes,
art.
Yes. And I think that fortunately, at this time in the American theater repertoire, we have some amazing works coming out. I mean, we're seeing Lin-Manuel Miranda write Hamilton. And I think that we hold value and we hold weight in certain art because it has been processed, it has been researched, it has been indoctrined in us. And so I think we need time to develop what is the next revolutionary art. We need time to study it. So we're going to need time for larger white institutions to study rap and understand the poetry behind that. And until I think there's that revelation that this is revolutionary, I think we're gonna have some battle between what is exclusive and what is inclusive art. To me, inclusive art, and again, I've been in the arts for a very long time, it's about what touches you at that moment. And I find that patrons get touched, they get moved, they find beauty in the art, they find truth in the art because they're able to connect with it. So it's either them seeing themselves on stage, they're seeing their story on stage presented. And until that moment happens, I find that people can feel excluded from what is on stage and what is being presented to them.
Now, Philip, you work for a group that would have benefited from the money that Prop 1 would have raised, right? The Intiman
yes,
Theater would have
yes.
gotten some of that money. So what's your take on how that money would have benefited the people who could have seen that work?
Well, somebody who looks at the financial bottom line of art and commerce constantly, I'm so excited to hear about donations coming in. And we could have received up to 30% of our annual budget from this initiative. So as an arts administrator, I'm disappointed that we haven't moved forward with this just yet, because I think that type of money can produce more art. We have more opportunities to work with various artists who are going to come in and tell new narratives. Right now, we're telling Dragon Lady, written by Sarah Porkalob. She is a local artist, activist, raised in Seattle. It's a story about her Filipino gangster grandma. And so we would have been able to take some of that money and put it into art like this. And art is always going to have a struggle with cash. And I'm going to keep trying to find that cash to create these stories and put them on stage. And that's what Intiman's about.
Shantina, we're generalizing a bit. You know, obviously class or race doesn't dictate the kind of art that you enjoy. It might have a lot to do with the kind of art you're exposed to. Could you give us an example of what people miss out on if they're only getting exposed to, I guess, the most dominant and big and well-funded art forms?
Well, nuance. In the conversation, representation in terms of who and what is American and what makes up the stories of our nation, right? And so much of it, you know, just to speak to a thing that Philip said before, in terms of, you know, organizations like Intiman, there are organizations that are invested in a racial equity lens and are doing that work, but they are far and few in between. So it's like, how do you then determine, all right, I'm going to give $300,000 to this institution that doesn't really have that and hasn't really begun that work from the inside out? I'm talking about from your board to your staff, to the outreach in terms of your audience and subscriber base. If you don't have that as part of how you think about art and the narratives that you are telling, then to me, it seems it seems counterproductive to say, all right, we give you the money and then you go find the people who are really doing the work when it ends up being such a small fraction, right? So $300,000, but you want to invest maybe 20% of that or 30% of that to the actual work. So for me, I'm interested in the institutions that are really doing racial equity work from the inside out, so that when you say, all right, what stories do we want to tell? You reach for a broad spectrum of people and not just the singular play in your season or, you know, the one story that's been rehashed from every angle many, many, many times over. You mentioned Lin-Manuel, there's Lynn Nottage, there's lots of good work, Terrell McCraney. Those are just to name a few that are coming out. And to me, they're revolutionary because they provide perspectives that otherwise mm-hmm. don't get included in a lot of the larger institutional seasons. They're just not there.
Well, Philip, how big or overrated a connection is there between money and that kind of the casting, the representation, right? The bringing in new works? What does money have to do with it?
Well, the art is expensive. Why? I'm asked that constantly. Let's take our last show that we just produced at the Langston Hughes. It was called Barbecue, written by Robert O'Hara, and we hired 32 local artists to work on that show, from designing the set to creating the costumes to construction. And I think sometimes people can forget when they buy a ticket to our show, which we have tickets for $10 available at the door, $20 available at the door, that money is going towards local work, and it's keeping money within Seattle. So I hope that people are reminded when they purchase local art and our product is plays, that they are helping this community out. And I think money is so important where you put it and how you spend it. So it's important for a patron to remember that when you put a dollar into an organization, to an arts organization, you're helping them fulfill their mission. And if that mission is community engagement, if that mission is, like Intimon, wrestling with American inequities, your dollar's going there. And then also what was mentioned here before is how is the institution spending the cash? And we have to remember, when we put on new works, you're engaging with an artist for a number of years, because it takes a long time to write a play. It takes a long time to write a musical, to develop it, hone it, make it popular, people want to talk about it. So when you want to get involved with an artist, that means you're going to be with them for some time, and that takes money. So you also have to be willing as an institution to engage with that work for a time. And when you're comfortable with something, you're willing to work with it. When you're uncomfortable with something, there's hesitation there. And I think that's when you share it, when you go into a new narrative, that can be time consuming and that can use money. So institutions are constantly weighing that out, I think, between art and commerce. And as the administrator, I have to look at both.
Yeah, art and commerce. Shantina, is there a moment, a memory you have of a time when you saw, heard a work of art and said, oh, this is for me. I see myself, or I see a way into the arts for me personally. Do you have a memory like that?
Do I have a memory like that? I'm sure I do.
I'm going to ask Philip the same question. So if you want to, if while Shantina's bringing up the memory.
Well, I'm thinking about it. Yeah, I mean, if I just go to my most recent one, I saw Lynn Nottage's play on Broadway very recently. I'm spacing on the name right now. But just a story relevant to working class folks that really crossed the racial divide, really spoke to the tensions in our country right now. To me, I mean, when you talk about revolutionary art, that's what you're talking about. You're talking about stories that have the ability to really bridge the chasm between groups of people that I could see myself in that work. One, because there were Black members of the cast, but two, because it was a cultural vocabulary that I understood, right? So that's, and that was Broadway. So you're talking about a commercial institution that was, you know, able to do it. But when I look at some of the interviews and the conversations and the work, I've watched Lynn Nottage's work go from, you know, being in smaller theaters to finding its way. I go, well, what were the smaller theaters that invested in that work early on? And why are they rarely in the dialogue about how monies get allocated, because that's the truth, is that because our communities, and this, the word community is kind of starting to be like a, you know, a buzzword. What are we talking about when we say community? But when we, when I think of marginalized communities that haven't had resources, they've been making work. They've just been making it with very little. So to me, when I look at the larger scale institutions that continue to get most of the grants and philanthropic dollars, I go, okay, great that they've caught on. You mentioned that they need time. And I'm going, okay, but while they take the time, what happens to these stories? Do they fall further into the background? Or do we reach out to those organizations and those in smaller institutions that are already deeply engaged in the work of elevating diverse voices? And that's who I'm concerned gets sort of not included or blocked out of things like Prop 1, right? That's, you know, that's a long answer to a short question.
We're talking about who the arts are for in King County, and I'll ask you the same question, Philip. Is there a performance, a moment when you thought, yes, this is for me?
Well, on a humorous side, I took...
Humor is okay.
Please, more.
Okay.
I took some family to see John Leguizamo in Ghetto Clown on Broadway, and this is some years ago. But I remember this was a request for my family to go see it, which was great because they rarely like to see theater, although I've been working in my entire life. They'll come see a show that I produce, maybe. But it was a personal request for my family to go see this, and I kept thinking, why? Why is this resonating with them? Well, John Leguizamo is a fabulous actor. He's a great writer. He's entertaining. He tells stories. I mean, he is not a Mexican-American like my family, but we have similarities within Latin cultures. It's humor. It's going to go quickly. It's in Midtown. There were so many positives to this. And I thought, well, this is art. This is high drama here happening on stage in front of us. This man has been cultivating this story for so many years. I mean, they came from his own personal life, talking about his father and whatnot. And we found value in that because we related to it. And so I thought that's key to marketing right there in a show, is how can I make this relatable? And I mean, there was a diverse crowd in the audience, and I have to think, well, they found some relationship to John at this point. Mine was a bit organic with my family wanting to see a Latin story on stage. But that's the key. And I think when institutions can provide a space for you to find relationships with the characters, find relationships, find yourself in there, and find it a lot, find it often, and find it in within space, I think that's success. And I think that's when people find Access for All, is when institutions are getting excited and care about what their patrons want to see and listen to what they want to hear about.
We're helping you find those relationships on KUOW. That's Philip Chavira, Executive Director of Intamin Theater in Seattle, and Shantina Vernon, Seattle playwright and singer, songwriter. Thanks to both of you for coming in with us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It was great.
KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We'll see you again tomorrow.